Hello, Susanna Lopez here, actor turned barrister turned broadcaster turned true crime writer and proud member of Sisters in Crime Australia. Welcome to the Scarlet Stiletto Bites podcast. For over 30 years now, Sisters in Crime Australia has supported our women crime writers, both true crime and fiction, and some criminal literary talent has been unearthed. Among many awards, there's an annual prize for short crime fiction, the Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And for those of you who prefer your stories by ear, in 2023 we commenced this podcast series, Scarlet Stiletto Bites, to celebrate the sisters' 30th anniversary. Each story is short, but not always sweet. Expect twisted tales, quirky humour, and a frisson of feminism. Please support us by following, sharing, reviewing, and generally spreading the word. We have no paywall. Today's story is from the 2011 Scarlet Stilettos, and it is truly cross-genre. Set in 2040, our heroine zaps back in time to solve crimes from decades ago. Crime Traveller by Liz Filleul. Blog. Hi, I'm Anna Thornton. I'm a 32-year-old time-travelling crime writer, specialising in investigating long-gone cold cases and unsolved mysteries. I've been doing this for 8 years now, since the earliest days of time travel, and have been able to reveal the truth behind some of Australia's most notorious cases, including what really happened to Azaria Chamberlain at Uluru in 1980. But you'll need to read my blog to find out. Welcome to my blog and enjoy. Anna uses the I Travel 2 for her time-travelling investigations. Find out more about the sheer awesomeness of the I Travel 2 here. You know you can actually use the I Travel 2 to set your digital recorder even when you're 100 years in the past? I said, looking up from the I Travel 2 manual. How amazing is that? I'm going to try recording the football on my next trip back in time. Oh, well, make sure you don't drop that thing in a puddle or you'll never get to see the game, warned Summer. Summer was my partner and a time-travelling historian specialising in the Gold Rush era. She swore by the raspberry time travel, which she said more than made up for not having the smarter features of the iTravel, by not having any of the bugs. You'll always get back with a raspberry, she trilled, quoting the raspberry time travel ad. I blew a raspberry at her. Well, I've never been stuck in the past yet. There's always a first time, she said darkly. I rolled my eyes. The eye travel and raspberry time travel divided public opinion more than public versus private education or any football team in Victoria versus Collingwood. Raspberry had produced the first personal time-travelling device just 2 years ago, and the iTravel had followed rapidly in its wake. Up till then, you'd had to go to time-travel centres to be hooked up to machines, and time-travel had cost so much that only business travellers and luxury holidaymakers had been able to afford it. Even now, personal time travel devices were a bit too expensive for every person and their dog to have them, but the next round of releases would probably change all that. Initially, the police had time travelled to investigate cold cases, but this was quickly deemed a waste of public money, given the long-dead culprits couldn't be brought to justice. So I'd started my blog, and the advertising it generated more than paid for my frequent trips back to crime scenes. Now I ceased my idle quarrel with Summer and accessed my blog. It was time to introduce my followers to my latest cold case. Blog, July 2040. Mystery of the month. Did she fall or was she pushed? The victim, Louise Matthews, 25, a primary school teacher from Mentone, Melbourne, Victoria. Her death? Louise was found dead at the foot of a cliff at Wattlebark Bay, South Gippsland, Victoria, in the early hours of Sunday, 20th of July 1991. She'd spent the weekend alone at her parents' holiday house in Anchor Street, Wattlebark Bay. An inquest returned a verdict of misadventure after hearing that Louise was a fitness fanatic who regularly went jogging at 6:30 a.m. She was found wearing a tracksuit and running shoes, and it was believed she had slipped and lost her footing in the half light. The twist? Jodie Munro, a colleague of Louise's at St Mary's Primary School Mentone, told police and the inquest that Louise had taken to spending her weekends at Wattlebark Bay, despite previously preferring to spend them at home, catching up with friends. After some pushing, she'd admitted to Jodie that she was having trouble with a man at Wattlebark Bay and she hoped to be rid of him soon. The colleague had said Louise had seemed anxious about it and she'd advised her to report him to the police, to which Louise had replied, "He is the police." However, the police had found nothing to verify the story. There were no signs of anyone other than Louise having been at the holiday house. No one had reported seeing anyone there, and none of the police in the South Gippsland area claimed to have known her. So, did she fall or was she pushed? I'm off to 1991 to find out. Anna. I added a photo of Louise to the piece, one that had appeared in the newspapers after her death. She'd been pretty with long, dark, wavy hair and had looked nearer 15 than 25, weighing only 44 kilos. Sometimes when investigating a case, I ended up going back to pivotal events, even months before the mysterious death. With Louise's case, I figured I needed to go back only to the day before she died. If the troublesome police officer she'd complained to Jodie Munro about turned up, I assumed it would be at some stage on the Saturday and that their liaison would no doubt be at the holiday house in Anchor Road. I'd have bet my last dollar on him having a wife and kids at his own place. Still, I'd need to get to the holiday house early, just in case he was there, and then when I'd seen him and discovered what they were up to, I'd be able to dig into his life a little more. Maybe some footage at the cop shop he worked at, perhaps shots of him playing footy with his kids. Then, finally, I could head for the cliff top around 6:30 on the Sunday morning, wait for Louise and find out what happened. I carefully tapped all my requirements into my iTravel. I needed to be inside the Matthews Holiday House in Anchor Road, in a room that no one had come near during the hours I needed to be there. I also needed the app that showed you where other house occupants were while you were there, something the Raspberry Time Travel didn't have, ha! And whether it was safe to go somewhere closer to film them. Obviously, the iTravel had an emergency app that, once activated, brought you straight back to the present. But you didn't want to have to use it if you could help it. Being spotted by people in a soon-to-be murder investigation could mean you showed up in files of the day as a mysterious suspect. I knew of a crime-travelling writer in the US that had happened to. The iTravel told me I'd be safe all day in a spare bedroom at the back of the house. Once I'd got that info, I grabbed the 1990s gear I'd bought from one of the local retro shops, kissed summer goodbye and hopped into the car. Because current time travel technology can only whisk you into the past and not through space, you needed to be within 200 metres of your intended location when you activated the app. So I had a 1.5 hour drive to Wattlebark Bay before I could begin investigating. I was interested in seeing what Wattlebark Bay was like 50 years ago. It looked unspoiled in the photos in the newspaper archives. Less than 100 houses, and just one pub and milk bar across from the beach. It had gone through a huge development in the 2020s, with a luxury tourist resort built on the headland near where Louise Matthews had plunged to her death. Enormous McMansions and trendy cafes and bars had been crammed into every vacant centimetre of space. That was one of the many great things about time travel. You could escape to idyllic spots when they really were idyllic. Until someone figured out some way of ruining them earlier, I guess. Angkor Road still existed, and I parked my car outside a humongous holiday house that appeared to be uninhabited, then walked down to where the app told me the Matthews property had once been. I checked out the best place for a safe departure. The iTravel recommended going from inside my car, as the other houses in the street were occupied. I got back into my car, huddled down in my seat, activated the Safe to Go app, and was told it was, and tapped on the Enter icon. I was hit by the usual headache and nausea. Then everything became increasingly blurry. It seemed forever till I could focus again, but I knew by now that the whole thing actually only took a couple of minutes. It wasn't until the nausea subsided that I could properly make out my surroundings. A double bed with a nautical doona, a blue chest of drawers with a model ship atop it, a painting of a beached rowing boat on the wall above the bed. The doona matching curtains were open, and the room was light, but no sun filtered through. Presumably the rooms the Matthewses used were on the sunny side of the house. I opened the door a crack and could hear the sound of a radio. A DJ talking over something by Madonna. With my time travelling, I'd become an expert in old music. I peered out into a narrow passageway with doors off one side and bookcases bulging with paperbacks lining the other. I went back into the room and checked my screen. It told me the kitchen was occupied by one person. There was no one else in the house. I wondered how long I'd have to wait till the policeman she was having trouble with arrived, if he existed at all. Surveillance is as boring when time travelling as it is at any time. I settled in for a long wait. True, the iTravel provided some entertainment in the form of games, and I also experimented with setting my digital recorder to tape tonight's Essendon and Geelong game. But really, all I wanted was for someone to turn up so that I had something to film, hopefully, and a suspect to go off and investigate. I'd exhausted my games when, finally, the doorbell rang. I tiptoed over to the door and set the iTravel to film through the crack, zooming in on the front door. Louise came out from the kitchen to open it. She took her time about doing it, something her visitor remarked upon when she finally let him in. I don't expect to be left waiting on the doorstep half the day, especially when it's this cold. I caught her muttered, sorry. Let's go straight to the bedroom, shall we? Charming, I thought. Must be in a hurry to get back to wifey, or the job. Because I could make out through the crack in the door he was in uniform. She didn't argue, but followed him silently into the bedroom. He closed the door behind them. Shit, I thought. Now I wouldn't be able to film anything. I'd just have to settle for sound effects. I checked my iTravel. Two people in the bedroom. It said I could go into the bathroom next door to it, undisturbed for half an hour. I scurried across to the bathroom, which was painted a lurid pink. Hideous. But far, far worse were the sounds I could hear from the bedroom next door. He was slapping her over and over again, and after a few moments she started yelping and begging him to stop. But he didn't. He went on and on and on. The first rule of time travel is that you can't intervene, no matter how much you want to. If I intervene now, I might prevent her death, which, while that might sound like a noble thing to do, would change history, not just hers, but that of everyone she came into contact with. So I just sat and listened, feeling powerless as my eye travel recorded the sounds of her beating. Finally it stopped, and I could hear the rumble of his voice, but couldn't make out what he was saying. I'd be able to find out later once I was back in 2040 and could turn up the volume on my eye travel recording. Then I could hear him moaning with pleasure, and at last there was quiet. I was relieved when the warning "Vacate room" suddenly flashed onto my screen. Hopefully that meant he was leaving soon, not just taking a wee break. I dashed back to the spare room and stood looking through the crack. Eye travel recording app still activated. I can't keep coming down here, I heard Louise say as they emerged from the room. You said 6 sessions initially.
Oh, that was before I realised you hadn't learnt your lesson, he replied. Keeping me waiting outside today has earned you another debt to pay off.
But I can't come down next weekend. I've got things to do in Melbourne.
You'll have to forget them then, won't you? He said.
Because we now have another appointment next weekend.
You made the choice, remember?
The night I caught you relaxing out on the deck with a joint.
I can still charge you with possession of drugs. I could even make it intent to supply. We both know it would cost you your job. And that's why I took pity on you and gave you a choice of being charged or allowing me to punish you. See you next week, he ended curtly.
When he'd left, Louise returned to the kitchen. I could hear her sobbing.
Bastard, I thought, and wondered whether, given the trap she was in, Louise's death might not be misadventure or murder. There was now the possibility of suicide.
I'd find out in a few hours' time, but for now I needed to visit the cop shop in Mullum Mullum and surreptitiously film Mr. Pervert Bastard Policeman, which meant going back to 2040 and my car. A couple of minutes later, I was back in my car, the steering wheel and dashboard slowly, sickeningly coming back into focus. I sat and played back the footage, turning up the volume. A close-up of him at the door revealed he was a middle-aged cop, perhaps late 40s, with greying black hair. He was well-built, as if he spent a lot of time at the gym. She looked just like her photos, only smaller and more vulnerable. Poor kid. She must have regretted that end-of-week joint out on the deck a million times over. I could now hear the things he had said to her. That she was a dirty little slut who needed to be taught a lesson. That she would learn the hard way that cannabis was bad for you. That she shouldn't be allowed to teach vulnerable kids, the way she behaved outside school, and so on. Then he'd ordered her to use her mouth, and the moaning had started. God, I felt angry and sick. If only she'd had the guts to report him, it wouldn't have been only her job at risk. Anyway, it was time to visit the South Gippsland Police Station in nearby Mullum Mullum. The policeman had almost certainly been based there, as it covered Wattlebark Bay as well. The police station had been located in what was still the main street, except today that consisted only of restaurants and retro shops, surrounded by street upon street of soulless three-story houses. I found a quiet car park. There was no other kind in the areas formerly known as CBDs, and pressed enter on my screen. I came through to 1991 in a public toilet. I always hated toilets as arrival points, especially after I'd come through in the gents at the camping ground in Uluru when investigating the Chamberlain case. The gents had been empty till the moment I walked out, when an old guy came up to the toilet block throwing me a dirty look. Summer told me the raspberry time travel never stuffed up like that. Still, this time I was at least in the ladies' room, and no one passed me as I left. Outside, I found myself in a bustling main street with old-fashioned food shops, bookshops, newsagents, and massive stores with names like Target and Meijer. I headed over to the police station. The reception lobby was small. There was a safety-glassed counter, and a woman police officer, probably in her early 40s, stood behind it. "Can I help you?" she asked. I'm not sure," I said. I'm looking for a policeman in his late 40s with black hair that's going grey. I don't know his name, sorry, but he told me to come and talk to him if I had any problems or anything."
"Oh, that must be our Sergeant Wilson," she said. "He's the only one fitting that description around here. I'll just call him."
I sat down in a vacant seat while she telephoned through to him. There were anti-domestic violence posters on the walls, along with anti-drugs and anti-gun crime posters. It seemed ironic given the cop I was here to see today.
"Oh, there's the young lady," I heard the woman say, and I looked up to see Sergeant Wilson.
He had black hair that was going grey all right, but he definitely wasn't the man I was looking for.
"No, that's not him," I said regretfully. "The one I'm looking for covers Wattlebark Bay sometimes."
"Well, I'm the oldest bloke around here," said Sergeant Wilson, "and it's a couple of young blokes who usually cover Wattlebark Bay. Mind you, we do get reinforcements from other areas sometimes, especially in the holiday period when there's more likely to be trouble. Can anyone else help you?"
"Oh, sorry," I said. I promised this guy I'd talk to him first. Is there another police station nearby I can try?"
I made trips back in time to two other South Gippsland stations, but to no avail. Whoever he was, he either had the entire South Gippsland police force covering for him, or he didn't work for them at all. I went back to my car in 2040 and spent an hour or so surfing the internet. Finally, I found a story that proved my new theory, and I cursed myself for not having been more thorough in my earlier research. The first story didn't appear until 1996, when the parents of a 14-year-old schoolgirl caught shoplifting had complained that the police officer called to the scene had offered her a choice of being charged or being spanked. She had chosen the spanking, but had then chickened out about meeting him in the park as he'd suggested and had informed her parents. A second story had appeared 2 days later, with two teenage prostitutes claiming they'd been offered the same choice. The police denied any knowledge of this, saying there was no one in South Gippsland Police matching the description. They suggested a bogus policeman was on the loose and advised the public, especially girls and young women, to be alert. The police drawing, taken from the three girls' descriptions of their bogus policeman, matched the man I'd seen with Louise Matthews in 1991. Once I'd found these stories, I figured I'd pretty much exhausted the investigating I could do. So I headed back to 1991 and the clifftop.
despite being an advocate of the iTravel 2, I didn't want to risk coming through on the cliff top itself, so I chose the bottom of the track that led up from the beach. It was only a 10-minute climb to the top, so I had plenty of time to find somewhere to hide to film Louise's death. I enjoyed the climb. It was just getting light and the waves were pounding in, exploding over rocks like shaken and uncorked champagne. Just a handful of house lights dotted the landscape. I thought that maybe Summer and I could take a holiday here one day. There was a lookout at the top of the cliff from which Louise had fallen. In 2040 it was fenced, but back in 1991 it just jutted from the track. Perhaps Louise's death had led to safety measures being taken. I settled down to watch and film from behind a convenient gorse bush. According to my screen, it was 7 a.m. Louise would be here soon. On cue, I heard footsteps. Not jogging footsteps, though. Someone was walking briskly up to the lookout in the opposite direction from which I'd come. He stopped right in front of the gorse bush and stood looking out to sea. It was the policeman, dressed up in uniform. I set the iTravel on to film. Then I heard the sound of jogging. Louise came round the fork in the track above, clad in tracksuit and sweatband, panting. "How many times have I told you not to jog on the cliffs on your own? You never know who's around," said the policeman. She jumped and stopped. "Why can't you ever leave me alone?" she asked. "Because you haven't learned to be sensible yet," he said. "You go back now and have a shower. Get all that sweat off you. Then I'll be round to see you. You can learn what happens to dirty little sluts who go out to lonely places on their own, asking for trouble." He grabbed her and pinched her hard on the bottom. She tried to push him away and he laughed and then let her go. "I expect you home and showered in half an hour," he said, and started to retrace his steps down the track. Louise remained where she was, looking out to sea. "Bastard," I heard her mutter, and she started crying again. And I sneezed. Shit! She turned around and was heading towards me. I put my thumb on the emergency app, but she grabbed my arm, loosening my grip, and the iTravel clattered to the ground. "Filming us, were you?" she demanded. That was the trouble with the 1990s. They had digital cameras and early mobile phones and thought our iTravels were some new improved model. "I suppose you think you're going to blackmail one or both of us. Well, you've got another thing coming." She picked up the iTravel from me and raised her arm to hurl it over the cliff. "No," I cried. "I couldn't be stranded here in 1991. I wrenched the iTravel from her and pushed her away as she tried to get it off me again. Pushed her as hard as I could. And she fell backwards off the cliff. Oh, fuck. It was me. I'd killed her. And worse, there were footsteps coming, running my way. I was trembling too much even to activate emergency on my iTravel, so I ducked behind the gorse bush again to try to calm down. I guess the policeman had heard her initial scream and had come back to investigate. I was right. He stood at the lookout and called her name. "Louise!" Then he said quietly, "Ah, shit, Louise." He grabbed something from his pocket. He tapped on it and disappeared. "I killed her, Summer," I kept repeating hysterically. "It was me. Oh, God, I killed her. I don't think I could ever forget that scream." It's okay, it's okay, Summer soothed. We were in our spa bath, surrounded by thousands of bubbles, drinking Drambuie, and Summer was gently massaging my shoulders and back. It was an accident, just like the papers said. Misadventure. They said misadventure. Well, and it was, wasn't it, in a way? Oh, what the hell am I going to put on my blog? I can't tell the reader she died because she was going to throw my eye travel into the sea. Summer couldn't resist it. Oh, you wouldn't have had to worry about the BlackBerry time travel getting wet. This is serious, Summer.
I know, she said. She stopped massaging and took a sip of her drink. You know what you are going to do, of course.
Yes, I said. Find that sick bastard. And I would, once I'd recovered from the shock I'd had, because he was out there somewhere, perhaps going back to the past right this minute, to blackmail some young girl or girlish-looking woman into letting him get his thrills. He'd never be caught in the past, but I'd make sure he was caught here in the present. I had footage of him already, and I'd get more so I could bring him to justice. I had dates for when he'd punished the schoolgirl and the prostitutes, and that would be a start. The footage would go viral via my blog, and somebody would recognise him. I'd be the first person to expose someone for a crime they'd committed in the long dead past. The police would be miffed their funding had dried up, preventing them from doing it. Still, they'd get their arrest. You're lucky he didn't realise you were in the house, you know, said Summer. If his time travel device had shown there was someone else in there, he'd have got out of there and come back another time. You'd never have got the footage or information you do have. I smiled. Well, that narrows the thousands of suspects down just slightly, huh? If he didn't have that app, we know he uses a Raspberry time travel, I said. The end. Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to get your feedback and we'd love to reach more listeners. Our website is sistersincrime.org.au and our email address is admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Until next Friday then, when we bring you another scintillating story from Australian women crime creators.